The use of sanctions against Ethiopia is really disgusting, and the removal of Ethiopia from AGOA using trade as economic warfare is very, very serious. And the Biden administration and Secretary of State Blinken are basically doing their best to weaken the country and force it into submission. And I guess we'll know in the days ahead whether they were successful or not, or whether the Gabi government will stand up and they will have to suffer more sanctions if they do.
Development economist Lawrence Freeman explains U.S. aggression toward Ethiopia at a pivotal moment.
That type of mentality was not common in Africa at that time. And for a nation to come in and just say, we want to do it our way, and do it in a self-reliant sort of way, moving towards self-reliance, was seen as a threat by Washington. And so they sent in the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, as an attack dog against the ruling party in Eritrea, the People's Front for Democracy and Justice.
Eritrean American activist and medical doctor Simon Tesfamariam discusses the U.S. attempt to divide Ethiopia and Eritrea.
Our government is complicit in this, and there's an effort right now to try to ask that the U.S. government stop funding the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa and consider more productive and sustainable approaches that come in the form of direct appeals from the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa.
Food security is one of the greatest challenges African nations face, and multinational agribusiness interests stand in their way. We hear from Professor Timothy A. Wise. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates across the country. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy is part two of our look into the role of the U.S. in Africa. The continent is still in the grip of neocolonialism, which is as repressive and exploitative as colonialism, just less visibly so. First, American officials are now in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, conferring with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, and no one knows what the outcome might be. On January 23rd, I spoke with Lawrence Freeman, a development economist with 30 years of experience on the African continent and particular interest in Ethiopia. You've been back and forth between the U.S. and Ethiopia many times since the war began in November 2020.
Yes.
Have you seen a state near collapse?
Ethiopia is not near collapse. And of course, I was in Addis for 2 weeks in December, when the U.S. Embassy was saying every day that everybody should leave the city immediately and they will help pay your ticket because it was about to be invaded by the TPLF. The country is not in a state of collapse. It's in a state of war with the northern portion. But the fact of the matter is that the country is suffering from financial distress. They've spent a lot of money on the war. Their manufacturing, their income is down. The world financial bodies are cutting off aid and loans to the country. And therefore, what the United States is saying is you're very poor right now. You're going to need the United States and the West to come back together again. And therefore, the West can dictate what those terms will be for the future.
There are a handful of states in the developing world, including Cuba, Venezuela, Syria, and Iran, that are standing proud, refusing to buckle to the pressure created by sanctions, by IMF and World Bank strangulation, military threat, and the like. Do you think Ethiopia will be able to join them in that?
This is the question right now that is being discussed. As you may know, both the new Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Molly Fee, and the new envoy, David Satterfield, are in Addis yesterday and today. I think what they're going to do is they're going to put a lot of pressure on the government and Prime Minister Abiy that either he goes along with what their dictates are for the country, or they're going to squeeze the country further, more sanctions, more cutoff of financial aid. Whether Abiy and the government are able to stand up to that, I don't know. There are signs that they're maybe caving in, but there's nothing definite on that. And they may decide that they're not going to go along, and like other countries, they're going to resist the sanctions. But the use of sanctions against Ethiopia is really disgusting. And the removal of Ethiopia from AGOA using trade as economic warfare is very, very serious. And the Biden administration and Secretary of State Blinken are basically doing their best to weaken the country and force it into submission. And I guess we'll know in the days ahead whether they were successful or not, or whether the Abiy government will stand up and they will have to suffer more sanctions if they do.
That was development economist Lawrence Freeman. His Twitter handle is at LFreemansAfrica, and his blog is africaandtheworld.com. No outcomes of the talks between U.S. officials and the Ethiopian Prime Minister have been announced as of this broadcast.
Africa, unite, 'cause we're moving right out of Babylon, and we're going to our father's land. Yeah, how good and how pleasant it would be before God and man, yeah, to see the unification of all Africans.
That was Africa Unite by Bob Marley. The motives behind U.S. aggression towards Ethiopia have not been altogether clear. Is it simply that they lost their long-standing puppet government led by the Tigray People's Liberation Front? Competition with China? Or is it the regional tripartite agreement between Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia, which poses too much independence from U.S. global hegemony? Ethiopia borders both Eritrea and Somalia, and Eritrea has made its Red Sea ports available to Ethiopia since leaders of the two countries negotiated peace in 2018. Together, Eritrea and Somalia share a combined coastline of 2,672 miles in one of the most strategic corners of the world, on the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, the Arabian Sea, and the Indian Ocean. I spoke to Eritrean-American doctor and activist Simon Tesfamariam, co-founder of the hashtag NoMore movement, to end neocolonialism in Africa. Simon, do you think that the primary motivation behind the U.S. aggression in Ethiopia is driving a wedge between Ethiopia and Eritrea, or between Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia?
Absolutely. When you think about what's been going on over this past year, they've been doing their best to try and isolate Eritrea from Somalia, from Ethiopia, with the intent of breaking the resistance that currently exists against imperialism in the region. Eritrea has been a long bastion of resistance against imperialism, and I believe that they think that they can win over Ethiopians and win over the Ethiopian government and pry it away from Eritrea. Same thing with Somalia. And so I think that this is the old divide and rule tactics that have been used during the colonial era. And it's what they're looking to do in the Horn of Africa at the current moment.
Tell us about Eritrea and its fierce independence. Tell us more about why the U.S. is so hostile to Eritrea.
Well, back in the 90s, when Eritrea gained its independence, the U.S. went along with Eritrea thinking that it would essentially play ball, that it would take part in its neoliberal machinations, that it would do its bidding, that although it had its progressive, you know, outlook, that it essentially could maintain the interests of the United States in the region. It didn't take long for them to realize that Eritrea truly had a self-reliant policy. When the World Bank or IMF would come to Eritrea to design policy for the country, you know, Eritrea would say, no, you know, we actually have our own programs and we were thankful for your assistance and your support, but we'd like to do this. We'd like to do this program our way. That type of mentality was not common in Africa at that time. And for a nation to come in and just say, we want to do it our way, moving towards self-reliance, was seen as a threat by Washington. And so they sent in the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, as an attack dog against the ruling party in Eritrea, the People's Front for Democracy and Justice. And basically, it was a regime change war. They wanted to take over the country and reverse its sovereignty because it felt that Eritrea was too independent. And so in Ethiopia, under TPLF, they had a willing puppet in a client regime. And so the target was always to take Eritrea out. And so going on 30 years, surviving all these conspiracies and attempts by the United States to reverse Eritrean sovereignty, to pull a regime change in the country, that failure is not really registered in Washington. They continue to pursue this strategy, thinking that they really have no other choice, because it's true, they indeed have no other choice. And so they're going to continue to try to pry Ethiopia away from Eritrea, the entire region. They want to pull them away from Eritrea. So to isolate Eritrea is absolutely a goal, but the strong people-to-people relationship between the Eritreans, Ethiopians, and Somalis at the current moment is going to make that impossible.
Okay. As I understand it, Eritrea has taken no IMF or World Bank loans since its independence, and it doesn't get foreign aid. Nevertheless, it's been able to meet the Millennium Development Goals that the UN set down. It's the only country in Africa that has met the Millennium Development Goals. Is that true?
Yes. And it's also the only country, or actually the first country in the world, to get rid of USAID. I know we saw, you know, all these conspiracies by USAID where Cuba would reject them, Russia, other countries. But what people don't understand was that Eritrea was one of the first to do that in 2005 or 2006, I want to say. And by getting rid of USAID, they were able to stop all the nefarious activities that they were up to in the country. Similarly, like you said, they didn't take handouts and aid and seeing it as a crippling tool. It's not anti-aid and anti-assistance from outside nations, but the feeling that it could be used in a way to control the country by strings attached, that was always the issue. And so Eritrea rejected this, and this has always been a problem. Again, Eritrea has a very independent policy, is self-reliant. So I think this is the focus of Eritrea moving forward and a reason why it sees so much hostility from the United States.
When you say U.S. aid, do you mean aid from the U.S. or do you mean more specifically United States Agency for International Development, USAID?
The latter.
Okay. And as I understand it, Eritrea met all of the UN's Millennium Development Goals regarding health and education. And despite not taking any aid or loans, crippling loans, it was the only nation in Africa that met those goals regarding health and education. Is that right?
That's correct. And it did it at a time when it was under sanctions, when you couldn't get basic medicines, you couldn't get ambulances. You couldn't get servers for electronic medical record systems if Eritrea wanted to put one of those up, install one of those in the country. So in so many ways, you know, it was challenged at every corner, and yet it was able to achieve the Millennium Development Goals, which I think is a story that really needs to be told.
What's the potential in the alliance between Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Somalia?
There's significant potential in solidarity across Africa. As we saw back in the 60s with the Pan-Africanism that had brought together many different African countries and pushed for liberation throughout Africa. Similarly, there's going to need to be something on the African continent that advances sovereignty and national development of these countries in a self-reliant sort of way. And so seeing three countries that are all connected in the same region, who are in an alliance that I believe is moving increasingly towards self-reliance, particularly because of Eritrea's involvement, you can see how this is going to be something that's going to be hard to break, because now the people see it. The key thing to understand here is that the people of the region see this as something that is necessary. And there are very strong people-to-people relationships going on. Somalis, Eritreans, Ethiopians are now having discussions online, in the streets, getting together, mobilizing on the streets. And so it's going to be hard to break that. The governments know that. They recognize it and are appreciative of it. And so you have the people of the Horn of Africa at home, the governments at home, the diasporas, all connected, moving towards this common destiny. And so I think this is something that's going to be hard for anyone to break.
And your own online activism, particularly with the No More movement that you co-founded, has been so threatening to entrenched power that you've been banned from Twitter, right?
That is correct, unfortunately.
As has the Horn of Africa Hub. And what else? New Africa Institute?
Multiple accounts.
Yeah.
Multiple accounts. Every account that I have has been shut down. And, you know, accounts that I'm marginally linked to, people within my circle. So it's insane. The level of censorship is pretty significant. And we also have, every new account for No More that has been created, whether it's the Horn of Africa Hub or No More Hub, they just get taken down. Even though I'm not even involved with it, or the people that got banned, they're not involved with it. So it's just any manifestation of No More in a leadership type of way gets shut down. The only sort of accounts that are still there are like these individual accounts of various No More leaders, but how long before they get taken down?
Okay. And just to make sure that we've got this covered, No More is movement No More to neocolonialism in Africa, for the moment, particularly focused on the Horn, but with Pan-African goals. Is that right?
So actually, the movement has expanded and grown significantly. It's become a global movement, although it has African origins. This movement needs to grow. It needs to grow in order to survive, because it needs solidarity across the world with all exploited people saying no more. Actually, what we are saying no more to, although you said it was neocolonialism, it's more than that. It's really three things. It's the tools of exploitation in the form of 1, disinformation, 2, division, and 3, war. When we talk about war, there's war on the people, which we can call oppression, and then there's war against nations abroad, which we can call imperialism. And, you know, just to use that definition, I know there are others. But by going against disinformation, division, and war, explicitly denouncing these things, we can then move towards a common destiny of like collective prosperity and push more of these positive things. So we don't want to just say no more to things. We want to move towards something that we want more of. And so we can talk about peace. We can talk about, you know, greater prosperity. And so we want this to be a shared thing across the world. So, but we can't forget that No More originated in the Horn of Africa, in Africa. And so now it's become a global movement.
Ethiopia and Eritrea were at war for nearly 2 decades until Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power and negotiated peace. Since then, the two nations seem closely bonded. Do you think the U.S. could break up that alliance as it seems determined to do?
So they'll make every attempt. And I'm not a leader of, you know, both these countries. And we know that the United States has been successful in dividing and conquering the UK, France, and other colonial powers. But as I said earlier, right now, there is a special relationship going on in the Horn of Africa. And it's not just two governments. It's entire peoples and the nations, the governments, the diasporas, they're all connected at this current moment. And they feel as though they have a common destiny. So if one leader decides to go off and do their own thing and maybe go in a different direction, you know, the people are going to say no more to that too. And so because of this force that exists in the, you know, broader community, it's a global movement, you know, we're going to have a say in where things go. And I think that it's going to be hard for leaders to turn their backs on the people. So I think that you're going to see a growing of this relationship between the nations of the Horn rather than more of the dividing and conquering. But you never know. Those attempts may be made, but we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that that does not happen.
That was Eritrean-American doctor and activist Simon Tesfamariam, co-founder of the hashtag No More movement.
Western media, you've been spreading lies just to sow confusion, just to destabilize. My sovereign editor, divide and conquer, your quest to take over my sweet home Africa. Mass migration has started, millions have departed, all the minerals you stole, you discounted millions of souls. Sanctions on restless sanctions, you'd love to see us kneel, but with the can-do people, we will never yield. And I say no more, no more, no more. And we say no more, no more, no more. And I say no more, no more, no more. And we say no more, no more, no more. And I say no more plague of neocon, military intervention on a peaceful, self-reliant nation. No more meddling, no more false narration. Don't you see what you've done? Africa, move as one. It's too late, we know your game. You sucked the blood from our vein. Children will never forget atrocities and pain. Can't you hear us crying? We must wipe away this stain. I say no more, no more, no more. And we say no more, no more, no more. In Sudan. And I say no more, no more, no more. So only and we say no more, no more.
That was Line Tedessa, music from the hashtag No More movement. You're listening to COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Food security is one of the greatest challenges on the African continent. And Timothy A. Wise, Tufts University professor and author of Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food, says that neither agribusiness nor faux philanthropic agriculture are helping. WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke spoke to Professor Timothy A. Wise.
Timothy Wise, thank you for speaking with me today. Please tell our audience at Pacifica about your most recent book and your latest research.
No, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you. In early 2019, I published a book called Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food, which was really a five-year project traveling around the world trying to figure out why the powers that be continue to promote chemical-intensive industrialized agriculture when it is undermining the natural resource base on which our future food production depends, and why they're not taking into account or following the lead of their own small-scale farmers who are showing that you can grow enough food, you can do it sustainably, and you can reduce hunger by helping the people who are the hungriest, paradoxically small farmers, grow more of their own food. And that took me to Africa and Mexico and India. And since the book came out, I've continued to do a lot of work on the proposed Green Revolution for Africa, the effort to try to modernize African agriculture through the adoption of a technology package of commercial seeds and synthetic fertilizers. And that research has shown that effort is failing miserably on its own terms.
What is AGRA?
AGRA is the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa. It was started in 2006 by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with support from USAID and other international donors, and set out with the goals of doubling productivity and incomes for 30 million small-scale farming households while cutting food insecurity in half by 2020. And so in 2018, I set out to look at how well the project was doing in the 13 focus countries that it had set out to work in, and assessed yields and incomes and food security, and found that yields have not gone up very significantly. They've only gone up for a few crops, not the most important food crops, that incomes were still pretty stagnant, and that food insecurity in those 13 countries had actually increased 30% rather than going down 50%.
You have written that AGRA's failure to live up to their own billing after 15 years, some $1 billion in outside spending, and very little, as you've just said, improvement. Where did that money go, and how did AGRA work to sort of undermine African agriculture?
Well, the path choice that Africa faces is, and it has the advantage of making these choices when it can see the results from other parts of the world, is a choice between building on its largely peasant-based agricultural systems and improving them, working with farmers to improve those systems based on their seeds and their technology and the ecologies, the varying ecologies of their different growing conditions, or trying to modernize that agriculture using Western technology, using the kind of technology that the U.S. promotes of commercially bred seeds, sometimes genetically modified seeds, and inorganic fertilizer made from fossil fuels, as well as pesticides and other methods. Promoters argue that that's the only way Africa can feed itself. The detractors say that it's pretty clear that the only ones who benefit from those technology packages are the wealthiest farmers and the companies that are selling those seeds and fertilizers and other inputs.
You've referred to the diminishment in crop variety as impacting farmers in terms of their productivity and sustainability, but also their security, their food security. Could you describe that in a little more detail and maybe give an example from either southern or western Africa that you're referring to?
Sure. One of the things that surprised me the most about the results we got looking at how the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa had fared in its 15 years of existence was the decline in crop diversity. And that's because the Green Revolution promotes a very small and chosen set of crops, corn being among the most promoted. And so what you'd see is slightly higher yield increases for corn, but you'd also see a lot more land being planted to corn because all these subsidies are being given to farmers if they plant corn. So, of course, more farmers move into corn and more farmers who have land expand the land they're growing to grow more corn. But the goal is to increase productivity, not to increase the land planted to corn. And they've much more increased production through land expansion. And that has come all of that at the expense of more traditional staple crops, which get none of those subsidies and none of that support and have to compete with these incentives for corn. Governments decide that corn is the crop that can be the food security crop of the future, and it comes at the expense of other crops. That has two negative impacts. One is farmers are growing more corn and less of other crops, and so their diets have gotten much more restricted. And the other is that traditional practices of planting multiple crops in the same field, so-called intercropping, which is very good for the soil, but also very good for diet diversity, right? You get a lot of different crops coming out of the same field. That's gone down as well. And so you see much less climate resilience. You know, climate resilience is a kind of a fancy term, but for a farmer, if you have four different crops planted in the same field and a drought comes and wipes out your corn crop, you've got three other crops that might be more drought tolerant and that can feed you. If you're just growing corn and the drought comes through, you got nothing. And so it's a much more precarious and risky approach for poor farmers in particular who don't have a lot of land, who have to make these choices. And that's kind of why they're not adopting these technologies unless they're heavily subsidized. And food security, like I said, in Africa as a whole, since AGRA was founded, the number of hungry people estimated by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN has gone up 50%, not down 50%. So that alone should be a pretty serious indictment of the Green Revolution approach for Africa.
How can African nations achieve food security? Or is it better to say re-achieve food security?
I mean, I traveled everywhere I went, in not just in Africa, in Mexico, in India, in the U.S. for that matter. I saw approaches that were far more effective that were not being taken seriously by governments and promoted by governments. The Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, which is the largest civil society network on the continent, has written to AGRA's donors demanding that they stop funding AGRA and start funding what they call agroecology, that is, ecological agriculture, farming with nature, and essentially building on the base of peasant agriculture and helping peasant farmers improve their farms and their practices. And some of that involves, like you said, sort of recovering and returning to older practices of intercropping multiple crops and things like that. And some of it involves, you know, real serious innovation.
Okay. Indeed, you have written that the Green Revolution is taking Africa in precisely the wrong direction. Why do you think it continues?
They will tell you that Africa has a growing population and is not going to be able to feed itself if it does not modernize its agriculture, and this is the way to modernize its agriculture. So this kind of aid is exactly the right thing. My research shows that it's not working, that it's a failure on its own terms, and that there are far better ways to improve food security, particularly for the poorest people in Africa. And that starts with some of the poorest farmers in Africa who don't need and can't afford fancy seeds and fertilizers. They need the kind of support that a group like the Food Sovereignty Alliance is promoting, which helps them farm better, certainly improve their farming practices, but very much in harmony with nature rather than taking them in the opposite direction toward monoculture farming, which in the long run is going to harm their soil fertility rather than improve it. And soil fertility is really where the answer lies in this entire equation. Our government is complicit in this, and there's an effort right now to try to ask that the U.S. government stop funding the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa and consider more productive and sustainable approaches. That's come in the form of direct appeals from the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. And hopefully next month, they will have a hearing with at least congressional aides who work on Africa to begin to challenge the notion that modernizing African agriculture is what Africans want and need. The Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa is saying that is not what we want and need. It's doing more harm than good. They will tell Congress that's the way we see this program that you are funding through your Feed the Future program. That Feed the Future program is up for reauthorization this year, and the Food Sovereignty Alliance is asking that it not be reauthorized. Not that the Feed the Future program not be reauthorized, but that AGRA, as part of it, not be reauthorized, and that funds be shifted to more sustainable and productive systems. The U.S. government should listen to that, and U.S. citizens should demand that their government listen to those very reasonable pleas from African food producers.
As U.S. agricultural policy, the big players in U.S. Agriculture, how would you characterize American agriculture's relations and interests in African agriculture?
Good question. What I largely saw, and again, I was a little bit surprised to see it, was how active U.S. companies are in African markets trying to open up markets for their products. The largest corn seed seller of commercial corn seed in Malawi was Monsanto. They're everywhere, and they're everywhere not selling just GMO seeds. They sell non-GMO seeds, too. But they're proprietary seeds and seeds that they make a profit off of and that farmers can't plant year after year. So the seed companies and the fertilizer companies and the pesticide companies have a lot to gain by getting Africa on this modernization path for agriculture. It means new markets for them, and they need new markets because their markets are drying up. People all over the world are starting to recognize that this is not a long-term solution, particularly in a climate-constrained world. And even in a place like India, the site of the first green revolution, we saw huge farmer protests in the last year that succeeded in forcing the government to back off from policies that would have undermined small-scale farmers in the field. They are also backing away from chemical-intensive agriculture. There's entire states that are going organic in India, and that's a direct rejection of a path that they've tried, which is chemical-intensive green revolution agriculture. They see their water tables deteriorate. They see their water quality deteriorate. They see soil erode. They see pest resistance to these pesticides and GMOs increase. They just see the package being destructive and ineffective in the long run. And they're, in many places in India, moving away from it. So U.S. companies need new markets. And Africa is one of the markets that they think is, in the long run, going to be big and important for them. Africa has a choice to make. They don't have to go down that path, and I'm hoping they don't.
That was Timothy A. Wise, Tufts University professor and author of The Future of Food, speaking with WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke.
La vie à mon abacala.
That was Koko Yakala Gambali Tonkara by the Congolese band Bendabilili. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The low vaccination rate on the African continent has most often been described as an issue of vaccine inequity. However, recent reports, including many from mainstream news outlets, say that the hesitancy or even outright refusal to get the vaccine is a major factor. Journalist Whitney Webb, host of the Unlimited Hangout podcast, spoke with Jeremy Lofredo, a journalist researching and publishing on the pandemic with A Gray Zone, among other outlets.
Since the COVID-19 vaccine rollout began, media outlets, analysts, and journalists that identify as progressive, both in the mainstream and in independent media, have framed their criticisms of this controversial vaccination campaign and the big pharma profiteering there within, largely around concerns about vaccine inequity in the global South. To these voices, frequently seen featured in outlets such as Democracy Now!, Jacobin, and Common Dreams, among other progressive sites, the criticism is more or less like this. The chief manifestation of Big Pharma's corruption in the context of COVID-19 vaccines is their lack of vaccine sales to the global South, with those populations being eager for vaccines if only they were made significantly more affordable and available. Oddly, other forms of profiteering by Big Pharma related to this vaccination campaign, the role of the military in the vaccination campaign, and also blatant corruption within the FDA and NIH are more often than not treated as illegitimate criticisms by outlets that would normally pounce on the opportunity to expose corporate capture of regulatory agencies and all manifestations of the corporate profit motive, or perhaps another industry like oil and gas, for example. However, as myself and my guest today will be discussing, vaccine inequity is really a much smaller issue than a lot of these outlets and journalists have suggested. While the claim does remain a safe take, friendly to left-leaning sensibilities, even official sources have been forced to note in recent days that vaccine supply issues are hardly the main cause of low vaccine uptake on the African continent specifically, as there is a documented minimal interest in the vaccines from the continent's population, including a majority of its healthcare workers. Now, with the convenient emergence of the Omicron variant, calls are being made to have Western countries make a major push to vaccinate the vaccine-hesitant African continent. Joining me today to discuss these complex issues and more is Jeremy Lofredo. Jeremy is a journalist and researcher based in Washington, D.C. He is currently a reporter for Children's Health Defense and contributes to both Unlimited Hangout and The Gray Zone. Last year, Jeremy and I co-wrote a series about the COVID-19 vaccination campaign and race politics with a focus on the U.S., And more recently, he has covered, alongside Max Blumenthal, the digital identity agenda behind the vaccine passport rollout. Great to have you on the podcast, Jeremy.
Thank you, Whitney.
So, as I sort of mentioned in this intro, just in the past week, some mainstream media outlets have been publishing reports about how vaccine hesitancy, as opposed to vaccine equity, is to blame for the lower vaccination rates observed in Africa, which they often refer to as the least vaccinated continent. So one example of that comes from CBC News, which I believe is the state-funded, you know, official outlet of Canada, from earlier this week saying vaccine inequity only partially to blame for Africa's low vaccination rates, experts say. Quoting various people, including one of the main members of the COVID-19 task team in South Africa, saying that the main issues are not really so much vaccine inequity, but health system capacity and vaccine hesitancy. The article goes on to note, for example, that 40% of vaccines that have arrived on the continent have not been used, and that's according to the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. And this has also been reported on by the Washington Post, some other outlets as well, and that it goes on to reference, in addition to that, that there's a lot of hesitancy from healthcare workers, with only 1 in 4 of healthcare workers in the entire continent being vaccinated or fully vaccinated, and that these healthcare workers in Africa have declined to do so due to concerns over vaccine safety and adverse side effects, and that's coming directly from the World Health Organization. And of course, this isn't exclusive to Canada's CBC News. This is also a story that was reported at the end of November in the Associated Press, republished by ABC News and a lot of other mainstream outlets. So now that vaccine hesitancy on the African continent seems to be an issue of increasing, I guess, focus from the mainstream media in the West, I know that you've done a lot of extensive research on vaccine hesitancy in the African continent in general. So what are some past events that could have led to this situation we're now seeing on the African continent?
Sure. So yeah, hesitancy with vaccines is not a new issue in Africa. And this is quote unquote hesitancy. This is not a word that I would use. This is blatant resistance. They don't want it. And there's several vaccines that have been administered on the continent of Africa that have had devastating effects that are not given to any other continent. And I'm assuming that the African people understand this. And when they're told that there's a brand new vaccine, they're very skeptical. And one of these vaccines is the DTP vaccine, the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine. It's a bundle of 3 immunization shots given to virtually every child on the African continent. But it's not currently administered in the U.S. or most other developed nations. And for a long time, as far back as 1977, The Lancet established that the risks of the whole cell pertussis jab, which is the P in the DTP vaccine, are greater than the risks associated with contracting wild pertussis. So after mounting evidence linking the drug to brain damage, seizures, and even death, the U.S. phased it out in the 1990s and replaced it with a safer version called DTAP, DTAP, that did not contain the whole pertussis cell. But today, African nations are still being financially incentivized to continue using the out-of-date, deeply dangerous DTP vaccine, with Gavi, Gates's Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, making DTP a priority for African children. A 2017 study funded by the Danish government actually concluded that there were more African children dying at the hands of the DTP vaccine than by the disease it's supposed to prevent. But the researchers found that boys were dying at almost quadruple the rate of those who had not received the shot, while girls suffered almost 10 times the death rate. So, of course, parents and children are seeing their friends getting these vaccines sent in by the West, and the ones who get the vaccine are way less healthy than the ones not receiving the vaccine. And this is something that you notice pretty quickly if it's happening all around you. And another vaccine is the malaria vaccine, which was just recommended by the WHO that it be given to the entire African continent. But from 2009 to 2011, its phase 3 clinical trials, funded by the Gates Foundation and manufactured by GlaxoSmithKline, took place in Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, Mozambique, Burkina Faso, Gabon, and Tanzania. And in 2011, their own data showed that female children were dying from any cause at more than twice the rate of those in the control group. And children who received the vaccine also had a risk of meningitis that was 10 times higher than those who did not receive the vaccine. And despite this, the WHO was still coordinating the administration of the vaccine to 700,000 children in these countries as part of, it called it a pilot implementation. And even the BMJ said that this pilot implementation process, it implies consent. So it means that recipients of the malaria vaccine are not being informed that they are in a study. So now this vaccine is being recommended by the WHO. Gates is WHO. He's the, you know, number two or three funder to every child in Africa. So these are just two examples, and the examples go on and on. So when these people hear that there's a brand new vaccine from the West that skipped most of the safety processes, they're rightly skeptical.
Right. So I think there's actually a couple other vaccines sort of in the same model, what you described with the DTP vaccine, in the sense that vaccines that are determined to be unsafe or unsuitable for public use in the West are more often than not basically sent to the developing world, where their use is incentivized by groups like Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, which, as you mentioned, has a lot of ties to the Gates Foundation. And a lot of people frame them as a philanthropic nonprofit. But if you look at their website, they make it very clear that their mission is not to necessarily protect public health. It's about the health of vaccine markets. They're specifically concerned about vaccine markets and creating healthy conditions for vaccine markets. And this is the type of language they use on their own website. And this is something that is not exclusive just to Africa. It also happens in Latin America as well. One example that you're probably familiar with, Jeremy, is the polio vaccine, whereas in the polio vaccines available in the West use inactivated viruses, but those used in Africa and where I live in Chile, for example, are live viruses. But even the WHO has called this out for being an unsafe vaccine in the sense that it's causing polio outbreaks, and it was determined not to be suitable for use in the West, but is being widely used and has its use incentivized in these other countries, despite the risks. And obviously people aren't being informed of the risks. They're just added to like the childhood immunization schedules. At least that's how it is here in Chile. And they don't exactly tell people that this is the polio vaccine for the developing world, and that the developed world has a different, safer version of this, you know, that sort of gets left out of the conversation. And a lot of the groups, including Gavi, that are incentivizing this use, you know, as I mentioned earlier, they're focused on finding markets for these newly homeless vaccines that were previously used in the West.
That was Whitney Webb and Jeremy Lofredo discussing vaccine hesitancy and or refusal as one reason for the low vaccination rate on the African continent. That was the African National Anthem, sung by Miriam Makeba. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by me, Anne Garrison, and Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.